Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, and we were about to meet the second of the prideful penitents on the first terrace of purgatory proper. You can feel me halting as I say all those phrases at once. We are in Canto 11 of Purgatorio in our slow walk across Dante's masterpiece comedy. We're at lines 73 through 108, a fairly long passage. It was impossible to break this thing down into a shorter chunk because this man is going to bang on for this episode and into the next episode, and I had to break him somewhere, but couldn't really until a significant bit of his monologue has been completed. We've already seen someone, the very proud or perhaps humbled or perhaps both, Umberto, under his giant rock as he trudges around this terrace. We've seen a lot of intaglios, marble carvings in the side of the mountain. We have heard a bit from Virgil, and now we are going to hear a long disquisition from, you guessed it, an artist. Oh, what else could it be in Purgatorio? Here we go. My English translation of Canto 11, lines 73 through 108 of Purgatorio. You can find it on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. I appreciate your support there and your commentary there, but otherwise, we are off to this wild and woolly monologue. As I listened, I bowed down my face. Then one of them, and not the guy who spoke, contorted himself beneath the weight that held him down. He saw me and recognized me and called out to me, even though he had a tough time keeping his eyes on me as I went along with them all hunched over. Oh, I said to him, aren't you Odorisi, the honor of Gubbio and the honor of that art which is called illumination in Paris? Brother, he said, pages like those laugh even more because of the brushstrokes of the Bolognese Franco. The honor's all his and only mine. In part. Truth be told, I'd hardly have been this accommodating while I was alive because the great desire to excel held my heart in a tight grip. We pay our debts here because of just this sort of pride. I wouldn't even yet be at this point, except that while it could be done, and I still had the ability to sin, I turned toward God. Oh, the empty glory of human capabilities. For such a short time, the green lasts on the summit, even if a foul age comes at its heels. In painting, Cimabue believed he held the field, and now it's Giotto who gets the cheers, so much so that the other's fame has dimmed. In like manner, one Guido has taken the glory of our mother tongue from another, and maybe someone has been born who will drive the first one and then the other out of the nest. The world's renown is no more than a blustery wind, blowing from one spot than another, changing its name with every direction. Will greater honor be yours if you strip off your flesh when you're old, rather than if you died while you still had Papo and Dindi on your lips, even after 1,000 years have gone by? That's a shorter span of time than the blink of an eye when compared to eternity, and not much when compared to the rotation of even the slowest celestial sphere. Dante provokes this discussion from Odorisi that leads to probably one of the most famous lines of Purgatorio. In painting, Cimabue believed he held the field, and now it's Giotto who gets the cheers. That line is so melancholic, especially coming from an artist like Dante, from any artist. Let's talk about fame. Let's talk about Odorizzi. Let's talk about who this Bolognese Franco is. And then we want to talk about some bigger thematics before we hit the really troubling bit about one Guido and then another, and yet someone else is born who may kick them out of the nest. We want to spend a long time puzzling that out. Dante's walking along and listening to Umberto, our last speaker. And you'll notice that Dante is bowing down now, farther and farther down, until now he can actually see somebody under these boulders. And not Umberto, who had been speaking, but somebody else, contorted beneath the weight that held him down. And this fellow, who we find out is Odorizzi, he sees Dante, he recognizes him, and he calls out. So they know each other. They're pals. Pals, I don't know, but they know each other. And he's got a hard time actually keeping his eyes on Dante as they go along because he's so crushed by the boulder. And we would have to think that in a passage about the various vagaries of artistic fame, that that bit of tough time keeping his eyes on a younger artist like Dante is probably allegorical or thematic. That is, Dante is moving beyond what Odorizzi and his art can do. And so while Odorizzi can see him, at the same time, it's hard to see him. And it's hard to see him, of course, also because of the weight of pride on his back. Dante turns to him, acknowledges who he is, and then Odorizzi begins his speech. Let's talk here a bit about Odorizzi and this Bolognese Franco. Dante says, "Oh, aren't you Odorizzi? The honor of Gubbio and the honor of that art which is called illumination in Paris." Let's stop. This is Odorizzi da Gubbio. And the reason we say Odorizzi da Gubbio, from Gubbio, is because of comedy. We call him that because of his position here. In fact, what we know about this figure who made those beautiful illuminations in medieval manuscripts, you know, where the capital letter has beasts and birds and creatures around it, or maybe the capital letter has a scene from the Gospels or a saint's life around it, that kind of guy who's doing even the art that goes up the middle between the columns or on the sides. And that art is particularly associated for a while with Paris, the scholastic school of theological learning in Paris, the great center of theological learning that Paris becomes in the 1200s. But this guy's associated with that. However, what we can actually say about this guy is that he dies in Rome in 1299. Now, that's important because 1299 isn't that far off from this moment. Maybe Dante, in fact, did know this Odorizzi fellow, because let's pretend, it's a guess, but let's pretend Dante is writing Purgatorio 1312, 1311, but let's say somewhere in that region. Well, we're talking just a little more than a decade since Odorizzi died. But again, who's Odorizzi? Well, maybe we should look at who he talks about. Odorizzi says, "Brother, pages like those, the illuminated pages I did, laugh," "laugh even more because of the brushstrokes of the Bolognese Franco. The honor's all his, and only mine in part." So Odorizzi says, "Well, the art of illumination was great when I did it, but it's now been surpassed by this guy in Bologna, Franco." Here's the big problem. And to get to this problem, I need to paraphrase the Dante scholar Anthony Oldcorn, who is the emeritus professor of Italian studies at Brown University. Anthony Oldcorn reminds us, and this is a really important reminder, that we cannot establish one single illumination from Odorizzi or this Bolognese Franco, despite the fact, A, that dozens, hundreds, nay, thousands of Dante scholars have attempted to differentiate between their arts, and B, there have been exhibitions of the art of, say, the Bolognese Franco. Actually, nothing stands on firm foundation, and there's a deep irony here. The deep irony is that this whole passage is about how fame doesn't last, and yet scholars are insistent on saying, oh my God, look at that, that must be Odor. You see, that's probably his. That came from Paris. I bet that's his. Or, oh, that's Franco from Bologna. Oh, that's his. Look at that. We can make some general comments about the difference in style between Parisian illumination and Bolognese illumination. And there's a way in which Bolognese illumination is a little finer. It probably had to do with the tensile strength of literally the hairs, used sometimes single hairs, to make marks in the gold. We might be able to say that, but we still know that Dante knows that. What we know, and the deep irony of this passage, is that Odorizzi claims to have been surpassed by somebody, and now Odorizzi is kind of forgotten. In all of that, Odorizzi is still got a little note of pride in there, right? Just a little bit, because he says, oh, the honor's all Franco's now, and only part mine. Oh, but he's hanging on to it. Only part mine. I still got it. It's just I'm not as famous as Franco is. Okay, this is all kind of ironic, because the point of this passage is the things that you do on this earth pass away. Dante scholars are intent on nailing these guys down and giving them an immortal fame, which is contrary to the very essence of the passage itself. Let's talk a little bit about the, what do we want to say, the laughter in the passage that we're looking at. Odorizzi says, hey, my pages don't laugh as much as the ones from the Bolognese Franco. All right, fair enough. Laugh. It's such an odd word to use, laugh. Well, of course, we'd have to think first about comedy, about the smile, about the way that art is to be not only instructive, but enjoyable. Laughter seems to be part of the crux of art for Dante. It's that the illuminations bring a smile to our face, and maybe even a laugh as we look at, I don't know, as we look at Peter sinking in the waters as he's trying to walk on the water to Jesus, and we laugh because it's so well drawn. This seems to be intrinsic to the kind of art that Dante wants, because after all, how many times have we laughed in comedy itself? And that Odorizzi says, oh, well, I still got a little bit in this game. People still know me a little bit. There's a kind of mordant wit in this passage. The smile is also mine. The reader said, dude, what you're doing is you're saying, I've been surpassed, but hey, don't forget me. People still see my manuscripts. This is all a larger strategy of the irony inside of comedy, and the beautiful ways this irony is gentle, sometimes very, very sardonic, sometimes very, very sharp, and other times gentler, more subtle and understated, and times like this just outright mordant in how it operates. The laughter may be part of the point. If you're enjoying this podcast, let me say that there's a great way you can support it. You can go to the PayPal link found in the player, in the show notes, or on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com, and find the PayPal link to support this podcast. I have licensing, royalty, hosting fees, streaming fees, editing fees, it goes on and on, to keep this thing afloat. And it would be great if you can help out. If you can't, no worries. I'm going to still keep walking, and I'm still loving everything I do. But if you can't help out, that is great. And thank you to the many of you who have done so over the last year. It's been kind of overwhelming, and you have really helped me cover the fees of this podcast. Thank you. Odorizzi goes on, truth be told, I'd hardly have been this accommodating while I was alive because of the great desire to excel. that held my heart in a tight grip. And we should just talk about this for a minute. Lo grandissimo, the great desire. This is the root of the problem for Dante. For Dante, desire is the central human motivation. And the question is, desire of what? Now, it's easy to see Dante in a kind of modern rubric of the pleasure principle, and that is actually a wrong way to see him. But for Dante, desire, disio, includes sexual pleasure as well as enjoyment, as well as ridon, laughter, in the manuscript Illuminations. These are all part of the overall rubric of human pleasure, not some kind of 60s pleasure principle, but in fact, this idea that humans are driven forward to find a kind of pleasurableness. And in finding the pleasurableness, they find higher truths. I think about, it just jumped into my mind, and I think it's right somehow here. I think about that comment by Nietzsche that the difference between animals and humans, I mean, how do you know when an animal ceases to be an animal and starts to be a human? Is because animals look for momentary pleasures, but humans look for enduring pleasures. My collie, he wants the pleasure of a treat or dinner or whatever, going out and running around looking for the ball. Those are the momentary transitory pleasures that he's looking for. My collie is not looking to build a lasting pleasure or a pleasure that will pay off in the future. And I think that we should see Dante in the light, I know, ridiculous, of Nietzsche. I'm still laughing at myself at Dante and Nietzsche in the same sentence, but that desire is leading to something grander than itself. And the way you get to an enduring pleasure is to have your desire correctly focused. Now, you can be religious about this and say it needs to be about God, or we can pull away and we can say, well, maybe Dante's onto something. Desire is the root of what presses us to creation, not just procreation, but creation itself, to the making of fine meals for our family, for the writing of novels and poems, for the reading of novels and poems, for the sheer pleasure of a walk in the woods with a friend. Maybe this, underneath it all, is what is leading us to some kind of higher truth. And Odorizzi goes on to say we pay our debt here because of just this sort of pride. I'm going to hold that because this sort of pride is problematic, and we're going to have to wait for the next episode to kind of unpack that. But let's just blow past it and say that Odorizzi says, I wouldn't even yet be at this point, except that while it could be done and I still had the ability to sin, possendo peccar, the possibility to sin. I still had the capabilities of sinning. I turned toward God. This seems very important. Remember, we talked about this last time. I did it while I could still go down an alternate path. And then he goes on, oh, the empty glory of human capabilities. Lumane posse. There's a play here in possendo and posse, possendo peccar, and umane posse, human potential. There seems to be something here about potential that is connected back to lo grandissimo, the great desire. That potential can cause that desire to go one way or another, but I, at the right moment, in fact, made the desire go the right way, so I'm at least here and not down there in ante-purgatory. Odorizzi goes on. He says, for such a short time, the green lasts on the summit, even if a foul age comes at its heels. Now, this is a really tough line. What in the world is going on here? The metaphor is just unbelievably ridiculous. So the green is up on the summit. So if you've been hiking in the mountains, you know that, you know, late July, early August in the Northern Hemisphere, way up in the mountains, the alpenflowers bloom, the tundra blooms. So, okay, great. The green lasts just a short time up there on the summit, where I live in rural New England. Yeah, we get about 5 months of green and the rest of it winter. So the green lasts on the summit a short time. And then even if a foul age comes at its heels, and it's right there that it's like, what? What are you talking about? Because the metaphor mixes. We were talking about mountains and the, you know, how it's green up on the summit. And then all of a sudden we're talking about history. a foul age, a corrupt age, a crude age comes. What does that have to do with a mountain summit? It's a mixed metaphor, a badly mixed metaphor. And you could say a couple things here. You could say that Dante loses control of his poem. It's possible. That's certainly one way to look at it. I like it this way. Odorizzi's not a poet. And so Dante is smart enough to not give Odorizzi, an artist, an illuminator, a miniaturist, and a manuscript illuminator, he doesn't give him the best poetry. Because this guy doesn't work with words, this guy works with images. And so his poetry is a little screwed up. For a short time, the green lasts on the summit, even if a foul age comes to its heels. It'd be like, oh, dude, stop mixing your metaphors. It makes my head hurt. But I think it may actually be a really nice characterization of Odorizzi. He's a visual artist. He's not a poet, like our poet, Dante. And then comes the big lines that we have to unpack. In painting, Cimabue believed he held the field, and now it's Giotto who gets the cheers, so much so that the other's fame has dimmed. I want to stop right there. It's really important, and it's really hard, to see this not as we now see art. We see art as, to use the cultural critic Jane Tompkins' phrase, we see it as masterpiece theater. Oh, here come the great works of French literature, here come the great works of Swedish literature, great works of U.S. literature. For a moment, step back and pretend, if you can, to erase all of that notion of what an artist is. Listen, by the time we get to Picasso, artists are commodities that are sold, and the value of art is based on the value of the commodity itself. This is the modern world we live in. This is not Dante's world. It would be better if you didn't think of this as big names, Cimabue. I know, there's Cimabues in the Louvre. I mean, these are now big, gloried, hallowed names. But try to get away from masterpiece theater and the Scrovegni Chapel with Giotto. Try to get away from all that and think of it as these two miniaturists or illuminators, Odorizzi and Franco. Think about it as craftsmen. And think about Cimabue in a similar strata as Odorizzi and Franco. The better way to look at it is as craftsmen. Cimabue was a great craftsman, but now Giotto is getting all the cheers. He's a better craftsman, so much so that the other's fame has dimmed. Is their fame connected to this? Of course. But the real quality here is not so one's become a bigger commodity than the other. It's that, in fact, fame is fickle amongst craftspeople. Think about not big art gallery places like Paris and New York and San Francisco and Tokyo and London. Don't think about those things where giant, big, important galleries are. Think about, pottery studios out in York or pottery studios in Santa Fe or artists who work around Mahone Bay in Nova Scotia. Think about those kind of artists. And think about how when some are working, they're very popular. And then, unfortunately, when that one dies, another one comes along. And now those paintings are much more popular. And that first one, well, they don't sell very much anymore. Nobody really knows who that person was. It's passed away. That'll give you a better feel. Because once we say words like Cimabue and Giotto, of course, our minds jump up at the masterpiece theater. I know, the Louvre and the Met and giant museums and the Prado. And good God, here are these giant masterpieces. But try to think about it as the evolution of craft. And the evolution of popularity through craft, and the way that if you're not really present, Cimabue, you're going to start to fade away after your death. It's really important to see that in order to understand what's going on next. In like manner, Odorizzi says, when Guido has taken the glory of our mother tongue from another. Now we've jumped from art to poets and people who work with language. And maybe someone has been born who will drive first the one and then the other from the nest. Oh, this is such a problematic passage. Okay, let me tell you how I interpret it, but there's a lot of controversy here. But I have a trick in the passage that I want to talk to you about. The first Guido is, I think, Guido Cavalcanti, the poet Guido Cavalcanti, who was just pre-Dante and, in fact, Dante's friend. Remember Guido Cavalcanti? He comes up in Inferno when his father comes out of the tomb with Farinata, and his father says, "What about, where's my son? You know, where is he?" And Dante makes a mistake in tenses, and the father freaks out and says, "Oh my God, you used the past tense when it's my son," and he falls back down in the tomb thinking that Guido has died. We talked about that. We talked about Dante's complicity in Guido's death, the way Dante exiled him from Florence, and Guido died probably of malaria in the swamps, and Dante's own recognition, perhaps, of his complicity. Remember all that about Guido Cavalcanti? Okay, I think that's the one Guido has taken the glory and of the mother tongue from the other, and this is Guido Guinizelli, and we're going to come back to Guido Guinizelli a lot over the course of Purgatorio. Right now, it's just important to say this is a poet of the previous generation, a poet much more back with Brunetto Latini in that world. These are different poets who are working in the new style, and Guido Guinizelli kind of is a founder of the new style of poetry. Guido Cavalcanti is a, a facilitator of the style, an adapter of the style, somebody who pushes the style further forward. And then it says maybe someone has been born who will drive the first one and then the other from the nest. And I don't know who this could be except Dante. That our poet himself is talking about himself here as driving the others from the nest in his great poetry. Now, I want to tell you why this makes people uncomfortable. Because they don't want Dante to be quite this proud. It strikes me as okay that Dante is proud on the terrace of the proud. And that Dante is exhibiting a kind of pride here that is being repented on this terrace. And a lot of Dante scholars don't like that because they don't want Dante to be so forthright to say, I'm going to kick these other two poets right out of the nest. You may not be as prideful as you might think, because what is the metaphor here, a nest? And what does Dante know about kicking things out of nests? The cuckoo is the European bird who comes along and lays its eggs in other birds' nests and either hatches first and throws those other eggs out or actually squashes those other baby birds and gets the false mother's food. If this is the case, and I think it is, that Dante is being referenced very implicitly as a cuckoo here, then Dante is not proud. He's being humbled. He's being put in his place. In other words, there are these two great poets, but then we got this interloper who's going to come along and throw things out of the nest, and this thing shouldn't be here. Dante's humbled, and we know that from the very opening line of the passage. "As I listened, I bowed down my face." Dante himself is getting on the level of the prideful under the rocks, and Dante himself is humbled, the cuckoo in the nest. But there's another way to think about this with Guido Cavalcanti. We're in Purgatorio, Canto 11, and guess what? Guido comes up in Inferno, Canto 10. And if we think back to Inferno, Canto 10 there, in fact, we learn that the heretics in Inferno 10 and 11 are in burning, flaming tombs. What are tombs made out of? Rock, stone, maybe marble, always a hard substance in Dante's day. What are sarcophagi made out of? Granite, hard rock. What are these guys carrying? Rock. We're tying back to Inferno 10 and 11. And who comes up out of one of those carved tombs? Farinata. And what's Farinata's problem? Oh, proud. That chest and that neck and that head that comes up and that speaks almost ex cathedra out of that flaming tomb. There is a way that this bit is referencing Inferno 10 and 11, where Guido Cavalcanti himself comes up in the mouth of his father, who's in the same tomb with Farinata. There is a way that the heretics are running around inside this canto. Think about Farinata's stance. Think about the way that Dante at first reacts very aggressively to Farinata and then backs up, realizes his complicity with Guido, as I interpreted it, and then softens, and Farinata softens. Think about how their very prideful Very self-determinative stances soften in the face of the death of Guido. And think about here, the prideful, crushed under stones. Think about the way this is all working on a humbling axis. And think about how here, these people are both humbled and proud. Dante, saying he's a great poet along with the other two Guidos, but also he's a cuckoo who is an interloper in the nest and so is humbled in his own poetry by this kind of backhanded compliment. Think about how all this operates, and I think you'll see the richness of a vertical reading between the heretics and the proud in comedy. Let's finish it off. The world's renown, Odorizzi says, is no more than a blustery wind blowing from one spot than another, changing its name with every direction. This is a common trope, right? We know this, that fame is not lasting, but it's nicely said. And I love the way that the name of the wind even changes. It's not just that the wind alters around the various quadrants of the sky, but, you know, hey, we even change its name. Its very character changes, as in Cimabue and Giotto, as in Odorizzi and Franco. The very names shift around and others are forgotten. Will greater honor, Odorizzi says, be yours if you strip off your flesh? It's a very graphic image. When you're old, rather than if you died while you still had Papo and Dindi on your lips after 1,000 years have gone by. How long does it really last for all of this to take place? And he finally sums it up. That's a shorter span of time, that 1,000 years, than the blink of an eye when you compare it to eternity, and not much when compared to the rotation of even the slowest celestial sphere. So we're back up looking at Paradiso again. We keep looking up there. Is this about the transitory nature of fame? Of course. Can we read this and now realize what a liar Brunetto Latini was in Inferno 15? Yes, Brunetto Latini's big, stirring, heroic speech, follow your star and your fame and get out there and do your best. Now we know that Brunetto Latini didn't have the whole answer. It's stirring, it's emotional in Inferno 15, but now we know it's actually hellacious because fame is transitory. And of course, can we see this in the general rubric of Christian theology? Yes, that fame is passing. It's what people grab onto rather than what they need to grab onto. It's the way they fill their grand desire rather than with what actually could fill that grand desire and get them to Paradiso. But if we step away from this for a second and just think about it, we might be at a weird place, and that place is defined for us by an old philosopher, old from the 1970s, old philosopher who's having a bit of a renaissance lately, Ernest Becker. You may remember Ernest Becker from writing his book, The Denial of Death. It came out in 73. It was quite a bombshell when it came out. It's kind of passed under the radar, and I noticed that it's suddenly popping up everywhere around me, The Denial of Death. Becker's claim, and it is a great claim, is that there are two levels to human existence. There's the physical level, our bodies which are decaying, and there's the symbolic level. And by the symbolic level, these are the ways we try to make meaning. Art, literature, conversation, dinner parties, all the ways that we try to make something mean more than just our bodies. Becker's point is that we are being tranquilized by trivia. That's his phrase. We are assuming that the symbolic world is bigger than our physical presence. And if only we throw ourselves into that symbolic world, whether it be, I don't know, buying a new BMW or buying the best clothes or dressing in fashion grade or creating great art or whatever it is, that we're actually trying to overcome death. We're trying to fool ourselves to think that we can actually beat our physical mortality. Maybe we should look at this in the same way. These artists, Odorizzi, Franco, Cimabue, Giotto, the two Guidos, Dante, that they're all working in this attempt to find a way to cheat death, to make something that will last longer than they do. And at the same time, they have to come to the recognition as an artist, as a creator, as a human, that they are destined to die. Now, the irony here is that what Dante creates does last. And we're still talking about it 700 years later, so there is an irony here. Dante did cheat death in some way, because after all, this comedy is still here in this podcast. And hey, perhaps I'm doing this podcast partly to cheat death, to say, oh, something's going to live far beyond me, hopefully, in some kind of digital realm. Okay, fair enough. But at the same time, I think it's really important to realize the transitoriness of life and the way that we do spin tales up over death. And we can take that into a theological context, but we can also take it into a very human context. Maybe occasionally, we should realize that the things we do don't last, and the things that we do pass away or have the ability to pass away, and that the transitoriness of life should bring us into a better focus with whatever our grand desire is. One more time, this incredible passage, Purgatorio, Canto 11, lines 73 through 108. As I listened, I bowed down my face. Then one of them, and not the guy who spoke, contorted himself beneath the weight that held him down. He saw me, recognized me, called out to me, even though he had a tough time keeping his eyes on me as I went along with them all hunched over. Oh, I said to him, aren't you Odorici, the honor of Gubbio and the honor of that art which is called illumination in Paris? Brother, he said, pages like those laugh even more because of the brushstrokes of the Bolognese Franco. The honor's all his. It's only mine in part. Truth be told, I'd hardly have been this accommodating while I was alive because of the great desire to excel, which held my heart in a tight grip. We pay our debt here because of just this sort of pride. I wouldn't even be at this point, except that while it could be done and I still had the ability to sin, I turned toward God. Oh, the empty glory of human capabilities. For even a short time, the green lasts on the summit, even if a foul age comes at its heels. In painting, Cimabue believed he held the field, and now it's Giotto who gets the cheers, so much so that the other's fame has dimmed. In like manner, one Guido has taken the glory of our mother tongue from another, and maybe someone has been born who will drive first the one and then the other from the nest. The world's renown is no more than a blustery wind blowing from one spot than another, changing its name with every direction. Will greater honor be yours if you strip off your flesh when you're old rather than if you'd died while you still had Papo and Dindi on your lips, even after 1,000 years have gone by? That's a shorter span of time than the blink of an eye when compared to eternity, and not much when compared to the rotation of even the slowest celestial sphere. Okay, we got half of Odorici's speech out. Now we got to get to the other half. To get there, you got to get to the next episode of the podcast. The easiest way to do that is to subscribe to Walking with Dante. You can rate it. You can write a review. Spotify didn't let you write a review, but Apple does and other platforms do. You can write that review in any language you'd like. It certainly helps me out. I appreciate the effort on your part. And otherwise, we're going to go on because Odorici's got more to say. And we're going to find out a little bit about exactly what are the sorts of pride that could be involved on this terrace. That's up next on the podcast Walking with Dante. I'm Mark Scarborough. And let us keep trudging along.